Well, great progress has been made in helping humans with failing organs or badly damaged limbs. Transplants have given many a new lease on life, and the science of prosthetics is now working with robotic versions of hands, arms, and legs to replace lost ones. Too bad we can't regenerate like a starfish, but Dr. Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado questions that assumption, which is why he'll be giving a talk at TEDxKC taking place this Friday. Dr. Alvarado is an investigator at the Stowers Institute for Medical Research, where his research centers on stem cells and regeneration. Seeing as he's just down the block from us, he was good enough to stroll down to the KCUR studios this morning to fill us in. And Dr. Alvarado, so nice to have you. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me and for the opportunity to being here.
You started looking into this how long ago?
I've been interested in regeneration for over 2 decades now.
Yeah. Well, back then, 20 years ago, how much was known about the process of regeneration? Because I can't imagine it was a whole lot.
No, you're absolutely right. There was very little known other than phenomenology. And by that, what I mean is that we knew that some animals were capable of restoring missing body parts when lost to amputation or to injury. But we knew very little about the cellular and molecular mechanisms that underpin these processes.
That's interesting. One of your challenges was finding a good organism for study. What were the considerations involved in finding the right candidate here?
Yeah, I think the main consideration, Steve, was that, I was likely not going to be getting younger anytime soon. So I needed something that regenerated robustly and rapidly.
Yeah.
That we could keep in the laboratory without necessarily spending remarkable amounts of resources for their upkeep, such that we could test and validate as many hypotheses as possibly simultaneously.
So what'd you come up with?
Well, I came up after a lot of cutting of a lot of animals from a lot of really interesting places with this tiny little flatworm.
A flatworm? Is that like an earthworm you see in the ground?
Similar, but not quite. These actually are aquatic. They live in streams. You can find them here all over streams in Missouri and Kansas as well. And they are about the size of a toenail clipping. But what they do is really nothing short of astonishing.
What do they do?
Well, you can take, for example, one of these animals and cut them into 18 fragments, okay? And each and every one of those fragments will go on to regenerate a complete animal.
Just to put
it in perspective, that would be the equivalent of me cutting my little finger and watching my little finger regenerate me. So these animals can actually do this, and they do it, reproducibly and robustly and in an incredibly short period of time. They'll regenerate a complete animal in the span of barely, a week to week and a half.
And the fact they're found around here, they were just perfect for what you were trying to do.
Yeah, so it turns out that they actually are present essentially all over the world. They're cosmopolitan. And I think the challenge for us was to identify the right species that would be most amenable for molecular interrogation. So we could not just pick any one planarian floating around. We actually have to find a very specific species that fulfilled a number of criteria that would allow us to access the problem of regeneration as rapidly and as simply as possible.
Why can the flatworm do this and we can't? I mean, is there an answer to a question like that?
There should be an answer to a question like this.
You'd like to have that answer.
I love to have that answer. And I think
it's a worm. Why can a worm do it and we can't?
That's exactly right. And so the remarkable thing we've learned for the past 20 to 30 years of investigating life at really high levels of resolution is that we have now realized that the molecules and the genes that are actually responsible for this thing that we call life are really old and are broadly shared by all of these species. So mm-hmm. What we find in planarians is that some of the genes they're using to restore their missing body parts, they're not unique to planarians. You and I have them. Other organisms have them. And the question, as you rightfully pointed out, is if we have those genes, why can they do it and we can't? And so that's really the crux of the matter, and that's what we're trying to figure out in the lab right now.
And that's the magical question. I just put my finger on here. That's what you got to try to figure out. Is it possible then someday that humans would be able to tap into that gene, activate it somehow, and off we go?
Yeah, that would be the expectation. And so I don't know how long it's going to take. I think I can envision the possibility of us being able to regenerate specific cell types. But at this point in the game, imagining, a human being regenerating a complete arm from scratch after amputation, that sounds a little bit fanciful to me right now. But what we're learning from studying these basic fundamental processes of regeneration are pointing out to the number of biological attributes that you and I have that we could conceivably exploit and modulate to begin to imagine the possibility of doing these kinds of things. But it's going to take some time, and it's going to take some experimentation, and of course, you know, a lot of failure to be able to get to the proper answer.
How do you, as a scientist, navigate that level of frustration where you can sort of see what the end point is, you can see what the goal is, and you see what the potential might be, but in the meantime, there's a lot of trial and error involved?
Yeah, so you can see, you know, in your mind what the actual destination should be.
Yes.
And oftentimes, you know, this metaphor is used that the journey is more interesting than the destination. Well, in science, the way we see it is that the answers, yes, they're interesting. But I think that what really drives science is the questions that we ask. So I think to overcome these frustrations, we have to ask the questions that involve helping us appreciate, why did we fail? Is it that we asked the wrong question? If we asked the question differently, would that lead us to a different path? And would that path lead us to a place where it's closer to the answer that we seek? So science, it really is an enterprise that's dedicated to coming up with really good questions. And the answers sometimes are a little bit anticlimactic, because it's the question really that will take you there and to places that you have not even envisioned when you started working on these particular issues.
You know, doctor, how do you put yourself in a place to try to ask the right question? Because you're so focused on this particular project, sometimes to ask the right question, you have to remove yourself and look at things from a different angle, from a different standpoint altogether. How do you keep your mind fresh and engaged in a way that you can hopefully ask the right questions?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Steve. I mean, I think removing yourself from incrustations of familiarity are absolutely essential for you to be able to come up with the right questions to ask. And one of the ways in which most of us do this is by keeping our minds alert to all kinds of things. So we love to ask all kinds of questions, not just about what we're working on, but things that interest us. So I think if you surround yourself by interested people and interesting people and what they do and appreciate what they're doing, this allows you to check your own premises, come up with a new way of seeing the same thing you saw before differently.
Yeah.
And by doing so, come up with questions that you had not even imagined, you know, just a couple of hours ago.
I'm visiting with Dr. Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado. He's with the Stowers Institute. He's working on regenerating parts for human beings potentially someday. He's giving a talk at TEDx Kansas City this Friday. It begins at 6 at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. The live and simulcast venues are sold out, but watch party tickets are still available. For more information, just go to TEDxKC.org. This is such interesting stuff. How long did it take you to grow enough flatworms to launch your research?
That's also a really good question. So, you know, we actually had to collect these worms in Europe. We found them in an abandoned fountain.
Why in Europe and not in Missouri or Kansas where they are?
That's a good question. That's because this particular species fulfilled the criteria that would make them really amenable for molecular interrogation. We wanted something that had a small genome size, so we wouldn't have to sift through a lot of noise to find the right genes.
Oh.
And we wanted something that had a composition of chromosomes that was homologous to ours. So, for example, I wanted a diploid animal, just like you and I, such that there's only two copies of each of the genes, so we can do genetics with these guys. And there were not many animals that fit this bill.
And the flatworms in Missouri and Kansas weren't exactly the right ones.
They were not the
right
ones.
That's too bad.
It is too bad. But they nonetheless regenerate wonderfully. And they do other things like are equally remarkable. But we wanted to have something that would just really facilitate and eliminate a lot of these variables such that we could get to the crux of the matter, which is to understand how they pull this magic trick. How do they do this regeneration after, you know, cutting with a blade?
So I'm imagining over at Stowers, you have a flatworm farm of some kind where you're growing these things and multiplying them like crazy.
Yeah, so let me tell you something. I mean, what we have at the Stowers right now is probably the only core facility of its kind in the world. This is a place that's entirely dedicated to growing flatworms for scientific research. And this is accomplished.
The right kind of flatworm.
The right kind of flatworm. Yeah. That's exactly right. The right kind of flatworm. This is accomplished because of the environment in which we're doing this work. I mean, you were asking me earlier, how do we keep our minds fresh to ask these questions? Well, you surround yourself with great people. And so I think that this is something that the Towers provides to us in great abundance. It allows us to really think deeply about what we want to do. It allows us to check our premises on a regular basis. And then, by extension, it allows us to generate huge amounts of biological material that we can now really interrogate in great numbers and in very high throughput, so we can test as many of these questions that are going to be wrong and frustrating until we may finally hit the one that is going to crack that nut open and let us see inside of this mystery that is regeneration in the animal kingdom.
So in your office, I'm picturing, is there just this giant aquarium thing where you're growing flatworms, doctor? Or how does this work?
No, my office actually is decorated with a lot of like old books. I like to read a lot of like history of life and a few other things. But no, we have actually a special room that is under constant attention by our colleagues at the Towers, looking at this the welfare of these organisms and their tanks. I see their tanks. There are many tanks holding hundreds of thousands of these animals that are now available for us, not just to interrogate, but also to provide to other laboratories that might be interested in actually interrogating the biology of the system as well.
I want to bore down just a little bit more on exactly what you're doing, because what you've mentioned here today is that this regeneration process is guided by the activation and deactivation of certain genes in the body. If it's possible, in layman's terms, how do you go about testing that, this notion of activating and deactivating certain genes in the body?
Yeah, this is a really, really good question, and that is really the bread and butter of what we do in the lab. And so there are many methodologies that we utilize to detect whether or not a particular gene in a cell is turned on or turned off. We also have methods that allow us to visualize the dynamics or kinetics of expression of those genes through time. So say, for example, if you have a cell in an intact animal and it's expressing gene A, okay, under normal conditions, that's what you would expect. But the minute you cut this animal with a razor blade, that gene A might get turned off. And that turning off, that switch, is what we're looking for. At the same time, shutting off this gene might actually flip switches on for other genes that get turned on. So we have ways to measure when those genes are on and off. And so we get a collection of genes that were activated, genes that were repressed. And now the question is, what is the hierarchy of interactions between all of these genes to allow for these tissues to undergo those temporal transformations that will be required for the animal to restore all the missing body parts?
So you're dealing with layers and layers of possibilities.
Yes.
And it must be extraordinarily complex. Computers are involved in trying to keep track of all this stuff.
That
I'm
is
sure.
Absolutely right. So bioinformatics, which is this new discipline, relatively speaking, by which we analyze all of these expression patterns, all of these activities of genes, is something that we use profusely in our laboratory to try to demystify and identify patterns in this complexity that we might then grab by the neck and say, hey, you're going to tell me how you do this. Because if you tell me how you do this, then I might be able to do the next experiment and determine which one of these genes or collections of genes may actually be the ones that we really want to investigate at much higher granularity and resolution to understand the process of
regeneration. And once you can identify that, that's the key.
Yes.
That's the holy grail here that you're looking for.
That's right. And that's the beautiful thing about biology, is that, whether we have hair or don't have hair or spinal cord or not, all of our cells and all of the genes in those cells are made of the same stuff, the same molecules. And so these molecules are of a limited number. So we can establish the individual order of the components of those molecules and then identify that particular gene based on that pattern of molecules.
Yeah.
And that pattern of molecules will be also present in you and me. So we can not only identify the genes in the animal, we can immediately associate them to their equivalents in organisms that don't regenerate or that do regeneration in a slightly different way, and begin to really get a much fuller picture of how these processes may have evolved to allow for this phenomenology to occur.
You're just killing me here. This is just so interesting. This notion of certain genes being active and other ones being inactive, that's obviously present in human beings as well. It goes without saying here.
Absolutely. And that's what I was trying to convey to you, Steve.
Right.
That this is a beautiful thing about biology. It's a unifying principle in biological processes that genes and their activation and inactivation are absolutely essential for who we are.
So, for example, we regenerate skin cells all the time, you know, but yet we don't regenerate my right arm if it gets lopped off through some heinous accident.
Right.
And that's another mystery that's sort of involved here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I think, you know, we are not entirely certain how these two things relate to each other. And so we try to come up with classifications of the different types of regeneration that may occur. So, for example, the example that I gave you earlier of a single fragment from a planarian regenerating a complete animal and the animal that was left behind, you know, regenerating the fragment that was missing, we refer to that type of regeneration as being bidirectional, in which both processes, both tissues, will regenerate complete animals. There's also unidirectional regeneration, which is like, you know, a salamander's tail when amputated will grow back, but the tail will not regenerate a salamander. And then we have the type of regeneration that you mentioned, which I like to refer to as homeostatic or physiological regeneration, something that's absolutely essential for our survival as human beings. You know, skin cells will actually die just by normal physiological wear and tear. If we had no mechanisms to replace them, we wouldn't be talking. I mean, we would have died a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we managed to survive, if we're lucky, for about 80 years. And throughout that period of time, we would be turning over and replacing these cells constantly. And this is a process that, you know, it's happening in many, many long-lived organisms, and one which we are all very interested in trying to understand.
And clearly, human beings have the capacity to generate a right arm or a left arm because we did it at one point.
Exactly.
So the question is, if we did it once, do we have the capacity to do it a second time?
That's right. And so here's why I think this is going to be complicated to figure out. Imagine.
Well, I get it's going to be complicated. That's coming through very clearly here.
It's not going to be trivial.
I'm glad I host a talk show and not trying to do what you do, just for the record.
I don't know about that. I find this much more difficult. But
believe me, it's not.
If you say so. But, you know, I mean, if you think about the time when our arm was first formed in the embryo and in the fetus, okay, that was very tiny. I mean, it's essentially almost microscopic. Now, imagine you as an adult. You know, I'm 52 years old, I lose my arm. What good would an arm the size of a little fetus be attached to my elbow?
Of course.
Or to my shoulder, sorry. And so it wouldn't be useful at all, even if we managed to do it. So now what would have to happen is that we would have to compress developmental time so much that that arm will actually grow fast enough to reacquire the appropriate scale and proportion of the arm that you lost. So this we don't understand.
But again, the flatworms do it.
The flatworms do it. Salamanders do it. But we don't do it. And so these are things that only happen in regeneration. And these are the things that we need to understand, that we are just beginning to make some inroads in understanding at the molecular and cellular level.
I'm just wondering, Alejandro, can you live with the idea, what if you're 52, you get to 65 or 70, and you haven't reached the holy grail of what you're trying to accomplish here? How will that be for you?
Yeah, well, you know, I would be disappointed with myself, obviously, but at the same time, I would find some solace in imagining the possibility that the work that we have done will be continued by others that we have trained.
Of course.
And so, and that is really the history of science. I mean, we can all scientists in my generation can trace back their ancestors in science through their mentorship that we receive and the mentorship that our mentors receive and so forth and so on until the very beginning. And I think it's a privilege and a satisfaction to be able to honor that mentorship by not only doing good work, but by teaching the next generation on how to do great work and hopefully allow them to become much better than us such that they maybe can solve that problem.
You know, I got a minute left. You know, just this month, the National Institutes of Health offered a new policy that would permit scientists to proceed with experiments to use human stem cells to create animal embryos called chimeras, if I'm saying that right.
Yeah, chimeras.
Chimeras. Mm-hmm. This has raised some ethical questions, obviously, very much like when Dolly the sheep was cloned. Mm-hmm. How much should scientists be concerned with how their research and results could eventually be used?
Well, you know, the thing with science is that it really is not about making moral or ethical decisions. It really is about dissipating the veil of ignorance. We are in the business of ignorance in order to generate knowledge. Now, what happens after that with that knowledge is called technology. And technology can be used for good or for ill. That's just inescapable. So a scientist, of course, you know, we worry about how the technology is going to be used. But in the work of science, we worry more about understanding the basic fundamental processes. And these methods that are being, you know, espoused to try to advance our knowledge is just another piece of technology that we think will be useful for us to understand the fundamental scientific processes that we're after.
Well, that was one of the most interesting 20 minutes I've had in a while. That was just fascinating. Dr. Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado, he's an investigator at the Stowers Institute for Medical Research, working in the areas of stem cell and regeneration research. He'll be part again of this year's TEDxKC conference. More information about that, TEDxKC.org. Thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
Good luck with your work.
Hey, thanks very much. Good luck to you as well.